You know, we're witnessing the transformation of the international world financial and economic system, in my judgment. And it's I put it on par with what took place at the end of World War II with the creation of Bretton Woods. We're in the midst of something new being born, and I don't think a lot of people in the West have caught up to that. What do you think?
Well, I think it's potentially bigger than that even. I think we might be breaking with the last few hundred years, maybe 500 or 600 years of history in this transformation. Because one of the things that is becoming obvious is that the current monetary system that we have is pretty much the source that is poisoning all other relations in society, and that it's at the it's the root cause of permanent wars, of misery in not only the global South, but increasingly in what we call the Golden West, you know. And this is always the same thing, and it always boils down to usury, because all the money that's in circulation is created as debt. It reflects debt, and it's only growing and increasing, and it has to be paid back with interest, and that interest compounds. So the monetary system is pretty much operating like a giant conveyor belt that's sucking wealth, or a vacuum cleaner that's sucking real wealth from everywhere where it's produced, and then concentrating it with this very, very small banking cartel, which is, you know, on the axis Wall Street and City of London. And it's inflicting misery on everybody else. And the farther it goes, the worse it gets. And so I think that the awareness of this problem is starting to spread. And I think that's largely thanks to the internet, because, you know, we get to have this conversation. We get to publish papers. They get to be read. People talk to each other. And I read at some point, you know, in the aftermath of the World War II, after the Bretton Woods Agreement, somebody there, maybe John Maynard Keynes or somebody, there they were talking about this, and someone said, maybe Dexter White, I don't know, said, "Oh, maybe there's a dozen or so people in the whole world that understand how the monetary system actually operates." Today, maybe it's a small percentage, but it's, you know, absolutely orders of magnitude bigger. And then, you know, the only game in town was London and New York. You know, the two financial centers of the world were London and New York, Paris to a lesser extent. This is who you had to deal with if you wanted to trade, if you wanted to participate in the global economic activity. It all had to go through either New York or through London, or a little bit maybe through Paris. But that was it. Today we have real alternatives emerging, which is, you know, the BRICS organization, China, Russia to an extent.
Well, yeah. I mean, let me ask you on that point, that China right now, the five largest banks in the world, I think at least three, maybe four of the largest banks are Chinese banks. Are they operating according to the same, infrastructure and purpose as the banks in London and New York? Or are they actually opening up sort of a new road, a new alternative?
I think they are operating on the same principle, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are inherently and inevitably evil, because even the Western banking didn't have to become evil and pathogenic. It was a choice. It was a conscious, deliberate choice, which was made. My impression is that this choice was made kind of explicitly in the aftermath of World War II, because primarily the British, they were the ringleaders, but the American bankers tagged along and pretty much adopted the same strategy. The strategy was to take the stranglehold of strategically important commodities around the world, but especially oil, and to make sure that they control all or as much as possible of the oil production and trade. And then the choice was made deliberately to keep all resource exporting nations poor. And that was formulated by Henry Kissinger in his famous National Security Memorandum 200. I forget what year that is, but at some point I think in the 50s. So there were initiatives by various nations. You know, when Germany and France started to recover economically in the 50s, and Italy, they started to speak with the Iranians, with the Saudis, with the Soviets, and they wanted to develop. You know, they wanted to exchange. Take guaranteed deliveries of crude oil at a certain price that will be agreed in exchange for technology. And what countries like Iran and Brazil wanted, for example, and Mexico, they wanted to develop their nuclear technology. And all of this was nipped in the bud. This is, for example, why the Shah of Iran was overthrown, because he wanted to use the proceeds from oil sales to develop a very extensive nuclear program. The same, the Brazilians wanted the same, the Mexicans wanted the same, and the Germans and the French were entering into contracts. And so, you know, the banking sector could have supported that. And they wanted to support it. Like German and French bankers and industrialists were already developing all these deals around the world. So we're talking about 1950s and 1960s. And then the New York and London bankers deliberately decided to destroy all this. So, you know, for example, there was a man called Enrico Mattei in Italy who pretty much single-handedly developed Italian energy sector, mm-hmm. their own indigenous oil industry. He went to Libya, he went to Syria, he went to different places, making his own contracts outside of the, you know, the Seven Sisters big oil. And then, you know, he met an untimely death in 1956, I think. Because he wouldn't stop, even though he was threatened, told to stop. Then there was a German banker who wanted to support. You know, the idea was always, we need your resources, but we can help you develop your energy sector. We can give you technology transfer. We can build out your infrastructure. And what Henry Kissinger wrote in that NSM 200 document. NSSM, I think, no? Yeah. He basically spelled out, not in those exact terms, but we're going to keep them poor and miserable because if we don't, they're going to absorb this stuff that they produce in their own economies, and then they're going to be very expensive for us to buy. But if they're poor, then they totally depend on us, and they're going to have to sell their resources dirt cheap to us.
Yeah.
And we're going to control all the flows, and everybody's going to have to buy from us. And then, you know, the cream on top of the cake is always that our banks are going to finance all this development, which means that all of their resources are going to be collateral on the books of our banks. And so that was done deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, you know, the heavy-handed... they just determined that nuclear was the energy, the enemy, and they did that. They decided at that point that they were going to try to slow down or stop the development of nuclear power development. And it was done that way. And that's why we had those oil shocks, 1973, 1979. Then, you know, Volcker came into the Federal Reserve, increased the interest rate to 16%, then to 20%. Basically, the effect of this was that practically it arrested, it stopped dead industrial development of the global south. First, oil went from, in 1973, went up like 400%. And a lot of these countries were basing their industrial development on oil, which was, I think, $3 or $4 a barrel. And then it jumped to almost 12. And then at the end of the 1970s, it jumped a lot higher still on the back of Iran regime change, 1979.
Right.
And I think it brought it to, at some point, to $40 a barrel. So countries couldn't cope anymore. And to keep buying oil, they had to go deep into debt. So they became more and more in debt to the IMF and the World Bank and other you know, private financial institutions in the West. And then that made them vulnerable to interest rate hike. So Volcker comes in, hikes the interest rate, and practically crashes the whole world. And then you had the big debt crisis of 1980s and everybody on the hook to the IMF and to the Western world, basically for everything, including food production.
Well, let me, you know, let's call this the colonial legacy. Suck the resources out of the global South, out of these countries that have been, you know, were occupied or controlled in one form or fashion by, you know, England, France, Germany, the Netherlands, the different colonial enterprises, and those countries didn't develop. You know, you weren't seeing the buildup of infrastructure. It looks now that China in the lead. But with Russia, lesser extent India, but the China really is the principal driving force now of, it appears to be creating a new model. Now,
yes.
Some may accuse me of being naive, but I don't see the same sort of locust behavior. You know, the locusts drive in and they eat everything. They consume it, destroy crops. And instead of destroying, it looks like they're going in and actually building up infrastructure in these countries and actually helping raise the wealth of those countries. And I think part of it is they understand if we get those countries more wealthy, they're going to buy more of our crap.
Well, yeah, that's exactly it, you know, because I think that, first of all, if you raise living standards, then you reduce social tensions and you reduce the risk of war. If you're an advanced industrial nation, it makes sense because you're creating markets with purchasing power that are going to be buying your products. You know, so you're creating a win-win situation where everybody, you know, like you're lifting everybody higher. But and this is almost obvious, and it was you know, banking and industrial interests in France, Germany, and Italy during the 50s and the 70s were actually pursuing this strategy, this approach. It made total sense. We have industries, we have technology, we have the know-how, you have the resources, and we can exchange this in a mutually beneficial trade. And then as your economies develop, you're going to be buying more and more from us. But these London and New York circles, and I think it's on ideological grounds. No, I don't think it was on the ideological grounds, because they actually, this group of bankers and economists actually called themselves, they referred to themselves as Neo-Malthusians. And what does that mean? That means that they were taking the ideological cue from Thomas Malthus, the East India Company economist, who was basically advocating depopulation.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, there's too much of this vermin, so we need to keep them poor and miserable, and we need to extinguish them from time to time to get rid of them all. It's, I don't have other explanation for it other than I think there's something satanic at the core of that approach.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, there's nothing inevitable about this. Banking can be a very useful service to society. It can foster growth, improving standard of living, prosperity. But it has to be, you know, you have to make deliberate choices. Hey, let's use credit to build out infrastructure. Let's use credit to build out the energy sector, industries, and so forth. You know, there's an old Chinese proverb that says, if you want to grow rich, first build a road. It's quite obvious.
Yeah, yeah.
So the fact that we are where we are is a bit astonishing in fact, but you can really trace it back to a deliberate decision that was made in the aftermath of World War II by the London banking cartel and their allies on Wall Street.